For more than 20 years, the Magic Treehouse series by Mary Pope Osborne has given millions of young readers their first exposure to chapter books. Osborne has written more than 50 of the stories. They follow the adventures of siblings Jack and Annie. Their treehouse is a jumping-off point for magical missions around the world and through time and space. In recent years, Osborne has been donating books to schools in need. NPR's Lynn Neary recently went with Osborne on a visit to a school in Massachusetts.
When Mary Pope Osborne wrote the first set of stories in the Magic Treehouse series in 1992, she had a contract for 4 books. She figured that would be it. But then she began getting letters from teachers, parents, and kids.
Those letters are priceless. I've memorized so many of them, like, "Dear Mrs. Osborne, your books almost made me smart." Or, "Dear Mrs. Osborne, I'm working on my own novel," second grader wrote me. "It's not finished yet. It's scary. It's called A Septic System." I can't explain that.
None of the 20 books Osborne had written before had gotten that kind of reaction.
I was stunned, and I realized that I was reaching an audience I'd never reached before, and that there was something about these rather simple books that was catching fire with young readers.
Now millions of copies of the books have been sold all over the world. They use simple language to introduce kids to literature, history, and science with fanciful stories like Dinosaurs Before Dark or Abe Lincoln at Last. A companion series, The Magic Treehouse Fact Trackers, provides a nonfiction version of these stories. The series has been so successful that about 2 years ago, Osborne decided it was time to start giving back.
Boys and girls.
The excitement was palpable in the library at the old Mill Pond School on the day Osborne visited.
Boys and girls, we have a very special guest today.
Hi. Wow, this is so great.
The author read to the kids from her latest book and asked for ideas for future books. Then she gave them some good news.
And guess what? Every one of you is going to get one of these books today. Yeah.
Osborne says after many years traveling around the country meeting her fans, she learned that kids in schools with a high poverty rate often did not have access to her books. So she created a program for Title I schools, which have a high percentage of disadvantaged students. Teachers apply for the program, and if the school qualifies, Osborne donates the books.
I see this series as it's been proven, I think, as a gateway into reading, that children start with Magic Treehouse and then they move on to harder books and they take a leap. So I see myself as just a launch pad, and I wanted all kids to have that opportunity.
When Osborne visits a school, she puts a book right in the hands of the children.
Okay, why don't you just stay where you are, and we're just going to hand out the books to you.
Kids crowd around Osborne as she starts to hand out her latest book, which is about soccer. Third grader Brady Stahelski has read all but one of the Magic Treehouse books and is eager to talk with her about his favorite.
Winter the Ice Wizard, I love that one so much.
Did you really? See, I did too, but I think it was a little odd for some kids.
Yeah, that's why I liked
it.
Okay, Brady, I got to swipe you and Aiden. You guys got to go back to class.
Oh, I miss you guys already. Bye-bye.
Great to talk to you.
From the library, Osborne moves on to classrooms, where she talks with kids about projects they've created based on the stories in her books.
Oh, these are great.
This one's mine
right here. Look at that. Now, that's Jack and Annie and the moon person, right?
Yeah, the moon man. Yeah.
Mary Bullier is a reading specialist for third and fourth graders. She says many of the kids in her classes don't have access to books at home.
It means everything for our kids. It starts this lifelong love of reading. We get kids who really don't read much at home. So giving them that book, it's their own. It's their possession.
Third grade teacher Christine Lavalle says the Magic Treehouse books are perfect for kids who are just starting to read or struggling with reading.
They have the same two characters. They have the treehouse. There's always some magic involved. There's an adventure that they have to go on, a mystery that needs to be solved. So as a reader who's just starting out, they can follow it a little bit better, and they don't have to build the structure of the story in their minds like you might with a text that you've never read before. So it just gets them ripping through books.
Well, congratulations. Thank you for sharing these. Okay, keep up the good work, everyone.
After leaving the classroom, Osborne said she never set out to be a reading specialist, but once she fell into this world, she realized she had found a new calling.
I promise you, my first 20 books were what I wanted to write. I wasn't even thinking about children. It's just what I wrote happened to be for children. But then now it's suddenly I feel I have this huge group I'm responsible to. So it's changed. My life has changed around the series.
For the good.
Definitely for the good. It feels a little heavier, the burden, but it's a good burden.
Since she started the program, Mary Pope Osborne has traveled around the country, from New Jersey to Alaska, and given hundreds of thousands of books to 1,800 schools. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Douglas Kearney's new book of poetry isn't necessarily something you might pick up casually. It demands a lot from readers, but the payoff is worth it. The collection is called Patter, and in it, Kearney takes his readers into a most private struggle, shared with his wife, to conceive a child, infertility, miscarriage, and finally fatherhood. Douglas Kearney joins us from our studios at NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us, Douglas.
Gosh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Rachel.
So as I mentioned, this is a collection about your personal journey to fatherhood, which was a hard one. And in the acknowledgments, you even include a thank you, I'm quoting here, thank you to the Mrs. Giles Whiting Foundation, whose generous award paid for the IVF procedure that made much of this book possible.
Absolutely.
Which is a moment of levity in an otherwise very kind of heavy collection.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we literally paid for the IVF procedure with some of this award money. You know, a lot of prizes and grants that artists and writers can receive, you actually have to produce something with that.
Not necessarily a child.
Not necessarily a child, or in our case, two. You know, but I wanted to acknowledge that here, not only did I produce a book, but I reproduced as well.
And may I ask how long you and your wife were trying to conceive?
We started, well, let's put it this way. We stopped trying not to conceive around 2001 and finally getting to IVF. That was in 2009. So we had been trying for about, about 8 years.
Yeah. Were you prepared, do you think, for how emotionally complicated the process would be? Had you spoken, did you have friends or family who'd gone through this?
I had family who had been through a number of miscarriages. So I was expecting that there was going to be a certain level of difficulty, that it was going to be, you know, really an emotionally harrowing experience. But nothing actually prepares you for what it feels like to go through this. I mean, the miscarriage, I almost got into a fight in a drugstore the day we found out. It was just really difficult. And even when I was writing about it, I kept trying to write something that would feel like it. You know, I tried to make it so I could write a poem that a reader would take in and they would go, oh my gosh, that's what that feels like. And of course, all of those things failed because I ended up either magnifying it so much and then second guessing myself and turning it into this sort of allegorical thing, or, you know, just completely underwriting it. And it was a very difficult process to deal with just from an emotional, psychological processing standpoint, let alone to try to make some art from it.
So on that note, do you mind giving us a sense of what these works are like and reading a poem in this collection called The Miscarriage, A Magic Trick?
Oh, absolutely. The miscarriage poems each take a kind of modality of performance, whether it's a stage patter, magic tricks, silent film or minstrel shows, and attempt to talk about the miscarriage through that. So this is The Miscarriage, A Magic Trick. 1. Stash scarlet silks in a lady's skirt. 2. Plant her among the crowd. 3. Call your shill to the dais. 4. Lay her on your table. 5. Conceal her with your bedsheet. 6. Distract the crowd with patter. 7. Apply a slight between her thighs. 8. Take hold the silk's loose corner. 9. Pull till it pools on the floor. Presto!
Hmm.
They're powerful poems when you read them. They are more powerful when you hear them. It is such a complicated subject and so private. Yeah. Hardly anyone talks about this. And the male perspective is even more rare to hear. Yeah. May I ask you to read one more poem from the Miscarriage collection, actually? This is The Miscarriage, A Bar Joke.
Excellent. The Miscarriage, A Bar Joke. Two guys walk into a bar. First guy says, "Yo, guy, why so down?" Second guy replies, "My wife just had a miscarriage." First guy says, "I know exactly how you feel. I just had my girl get an abortion."
A little different experience.
Yeah. Variations of that happened to me twice.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How? People said things like that?
Yeah, yeah. I had two male friends on two separate occasions take me out after the miscarriage. And each one of them talked about a girlfriend. One had had his girlfriend get an abortion, and the other had been worried that she might be pregnant, but it hadn't taken. And I mean, at the time, you know, there's this huge mix of feelings of like, you know, like this anger, like, how dare you compare your not wanting a kid with my wanting a kid? And so there was that. But there was also this real thing, which is, how are men supposed to talk about this? What are we supposed to say to each other when this happens? And I didn't think of it ultimately as a purely gross miscalculation. It really was this attempt that you just have to laugh about it later. I mean, this poem in particular took a while to get to because there was a lot of anger, and that was what was coming out in those earlier versions of this poem. And I wanted it to be a little less like I was throwing these guys under the bus for really actually trying to help me. Mm. But we just didn't have the tools.
Mm. You had twins.
Yes.
But you allude to the possibility of other children in a poem called New Parents. I wonder if you could read that.
Absolutely. New Parents. Pick through your blood, but you won't find what must be done with the others, the ones in ice where you belong. Choosing worries you in its mouths. Lose them to strange names and houses, board them ever in deer freezers, or let them thaw and spoil. Those you've chosen doze under wool. Think of all the night's cool siblings. Take them hand in hand and lead them down the bleak rounds to your judgment. And when their cries rise through night's slab, driving you beset against their cribs, do they grieve for those whom they have lost, or what they must have? Your eyes burnt with love, your teeth keen on silence.
It is such a strange thing, isn't it? That part of the process and the associated grief. Is that the right word?
I think so. I mean, with IVF, I mean, if you end up having a lot of eggs, you know, the doctor will fertilize them all, attempt to fertilize them all. And after you've had a success, you suddenly have to have this this question of like, well, what do we do with the other ones? And there's not a rule of what you're supposed to do. And, you know, these are full siblings. It's not half. It's not potential. They are their siblings. And one day we're going to have to explain that to them.
And you will do that?
I think so. I mean, I think that they should know a bit about what it took to bring them here, that they are special, you know, that we wanted them so badly, and here they are.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, Douglas Kearney. His new poetry collection is called Patter. Happy Father's Day, Douglas.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Every big political scandal produces books that detail what happened, but none quite like the one that came out 40 years ago this summer. Steve Inskeep met the authors of that book.
It's a book many people know simply as That Movie.
All the President's Men,
The story of the two young reporters who cracked the Watergate conspiracy.
White House.
Howard Hunt, please.
He might be in Mr. Colson's office.
Who's Charles Colson?
It's the only hit movie ever made about two young guys making phone calls, organizing paper notes, and meeting a source called Deep Throat in a parking garage. Before the movie, there was a book, and before the book, a true story. The story of two reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. They investigated the Watergate scandal, and the other day they met us inside the Watergate Hotel and Office Complex in Washington, D.C. We were in vacant, white-walled offices on the sixth floor. In June 1972, those offices were the headquarters of the National Democratic Party and the scene of a crime.
I know the first week I came over here, I think you did too at some point.
I think when we heard about Baldwin we came over, right?
That was later.
Baldwin, one of the men involved in planting listening devices inside the Democratic headquarters. Burglars trying to maintain those devices were caught inside the Watergate.
What do you guys think about when you walk around here and think about what was here at one time?
First, I had to get oriented and then try to visualize how the arrests took place in here.
Looking around decades later, Carl Bernstein found himself comparing these burgundy-carpeted empty rooms with the way they looked in the film.
In the movie, you see the arrests. So that's my recollection is coming from the movie because I have no previous knowledge physically of exactly what rooms, etc.
That was the point of all the president's men. The two reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, were trying to figure out events they had not seen. Working for the Washington Post, they slowly connected the burglary and other political crimes to the re-election campaign of President Richard Nixon. They won a Pulitzer Prize, though Nixon was still in office in 1974 when they published their book. In it, they write of their investigation, their scoops, and their failings.
So do you remember which one of you wrote the line that Woodward was considered such a poor writer, the rumor was that English was not his first language?
I think I wrote,
He wrote it. I know he did.
The book is less about Nixon than about two reporters searching for truth.
Whose idea was it to write the book as basically a detective story starring two reporters?
We had little choice because we had signed up to do a book that we thought maybe would explain what Watergate was about. And we were fearful that the truth would never become known of what had happened.
But as publication neared, the truth was finally being revealed in congressional hearings. So the two men who largely broke the Watergate story had little more to say except their own stories.
One of the rules of writing is write what you know.
All the President's Men is essentially about journalism. It shows the reporters trying to get the story right and also trying to sell it. Their book, which has now been reissued, includes a reference to the creation of their book. Woodward and Bernstein had a lunch with a publisher. They went through that lunch with a feeling of horror because that same morning they had made a serious mistake on the front page of the Washington Post. Their story said a witness had given testimony to a grand jury about White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman.
This was one of the real dreary days of our reporting life. In fact, I don't think I've had one that bad because it was just flat wrong, but we'd done so much reporting that we knew Haldeman was at the center of this, and Mark Felt later told us that it was a Haldeman operation, which all of the tapes and everything else have demonstrated.
Mark Felt, the man described as Deep Throat. Go ahead, Carl Bernstein.
Well, we had the story right, the substance of it. What we had wrong was the attribution. It had never come before the grand jury, and it was the substance that was really important. And at the same time, we had not been diligent in nailing this down, this one aspect of it. It was a day like today. It was raining like crazy. And here we were meeting with this publisher that wanted to do a book with us, and we were talking about whether we were going to have to resign from the paper or not, talking in a very serious way. You got to remember that the stakes of this thing by now were so high that the President of the United States and his spokespeople almost every day were attacking the Washington Post for using innuendo and hearsay information, and we had been assiduous and careful, and people were starting to really believe the stories we had written, and boom, came this, and it looked like it could all be over.
You had based your reporting up to then on conversations with sources, talking to people.
And the key, and this was a strategy that Carl developed, go see these people at home at night when they're relaxed, when there are no press people around, when the time is limitless to a certain extent, and you're there saying, help me, I need your help, which are the most potent words in journalism, and people will kind of unburden themselves or at least tell part of the story.
Part of the story. During all of their months of reporting a story that was ultimately about President Richard Nixon, they never met the president. Even in the years afterward, they never met him. Would either of you have a question for him today if you had an opportunity to go back in time and throw a question at Richard Nixon, however large or small?
Well, the question would be if you could get an answer, why?
Yeah.
Why a president who was heading for re-election anyway went to such extremes to win?
And the answer of why, he even raises it himself in his farewell from the White House. It was so mesmerizing when you watched it, that when you let your anger and hate rule you, that's when you do this terrible thing to yourself.
And literally what he said is, always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win
unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
Richard Nixon, who resigned 40 years ago this summer. Also 40 years ago came the publication of All the President's Men by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
Anthony Breznican reports on Hollywood for Entertainment Weekly. And like many people in Hollywood, he's got a story to tell. What's very un-Hollywood is that he's doing it in a novel. But he does have a Hollywood pitch.
It's kind of like Fight Club meets The Breakfast Club.
It's called Brutal Youth, a story of life at a Catholic high school where students cope with bullying by laying low, taking the punishment, or becoming bullies themselves. You might say you can find bullying in one form or another in just about every high school, but things are a little different at St. Michael the Archangel.
They've institutionalized it. It's sanctioned hazing, and this comes from my experience as a high school student. Coming in as a little tiny freshman, 14 years old, and you're told, okay, well, there's this thing called initiation, and you're going to be, you know, picked on slash protected by some senior. And you don't know who you get. You get some sadist, and you're in really bad shape, you know. And this was the early 90s, and they saw it as sort of a harmless thing. It had been a tradition for as far back as anyone could remember. But at the time, it was terrifying. There's a lot of ways that people who are powerless assert dominance over each other. It's a way of saying, I'm not at the bottom of the totem pole. I'm able to climb up because I'm putting a foot on your neck. And the only rule in the school really is you can't pick on anybody who can actually hurt you back.
So let's talk about the characters in this book. The three main characters, their kind of introduction to this school as their freshmen, it's one of the upperclassmen who's basically kind of lost his mind.
He snapped, yeah. The book begins with what I hoped would be kind of an exciting, perilous action sequence. You know, I remember in high school studying Shakespeare, and my English teacher said, notice how often he starts with an argument or a fight. That's how you get the attention of the audience. So I wanted to start with something kind of intense. And also thematically, I wanted to show, we're going to follow these three freshmen through their first year in high school. They're good kids. What happens to make a kid like that turn hard, turn sour, turn bitter? And I wanted to show the worst case scenario. And so we begin with a kid who's been pushed around and finally breaks. He snaps and he does something that he can't take back. And in that act of violence, he climbs up to the roof to get away from something he's done. And he ends up pushing over these saints, these stone statues, trying to hit the people below. And I thought, that's pretty terrifying. So we can have our main characters kind of run out and try to be the heroes. And you see them trying to do the right thing. And as the story goes on, you see how a kid goes from someone who'll run out in the middle of danger to save somebody he doesn't even know to possibly becoming the one who's trying to cause the pain.
Well, there is. I mean, the book is very dark. Yeah. But at the same time, there's this bullying. You know, these two male characters, Peter Davidek and Noah Stein, they have a really powerful friendship.
Yeah. You know, the people who are with you when you're kind of in that embryonic stage of being a teenager, figuring out who you are, I think those are the people who make a difference for you, and you never forget them. Those are like foxhole friendships, mm-hmm. you know? And the friend who takes the punch, who takes the blame, who absorbs the insult when they know you can't take any more, those are priceless friendships. And I wanted to sort of pay tribute to that in this story. And to do that, I had to put the kids through some really bad stuff.
And in terms of the bad stuff, Peter and Noah have different ideas about how you survive high school. Could you talk about their approaches?
You know, Peter Davidek, he's, you know, a lot like me. I think when I was that age, I just wanted to lay low, wanted to do my thing and not make any waves. And Noah Stein is that side of me that's like, you know, you got to pick your battles. Let's pick everyone. Let's pick every fight. He really means well, but there's no fight he won't take as long as it's for the right cause. He doesn't pick on anybody.
You have a character named Hannah, who she's one of the older students there, and she's been so tormented. She's changed her hair color multiple times to try to
change her appearance. You know, she's a kind of mysterious character for about half of the book. Hannah was one of the most picked upon students at this school over 4 years. And to protect herself, she has been kind of like Madame Defarge in A Tale of Two Cities. She sits quietly and gathers everyone's secrets. She overhears a lot of things. And so at the end of the year, there's this big picnic, and they have a little talent show. That was considered the end of your initiation, this kind of talent show. And her plan is to take her freshman and force him to read in front of the audience her little collection of secrets. She's going to kind of throw a match over her shoulder as she leaves the school. And she's going to use one of the freshmen to sort of strike that match or to be the match. And any kid who does that is doomed for the next 3 years. You're not going to make it out of your freshman hazing. You're going to be the kid who embarrassed everyone.
You know, it's almost impossible to read this and be thinking about high school and bullying and not think about, you know, today, social media, because the things that have this power in this book, like the secrets that say Hannah has, I don't know if it's better or worse now that there is social media involved.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the diary, the handwritten diary, was my effort to kind of, this story is set in 1991, and I wanted that to be a little bit representative of what we face today with kids being bullied and called names on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, you know, any kind of social media could be used as a blunt instrument in the wrong hands. And I think this is the analog version of that. The reason that's such a powerfully intimidating format is whatever name you're being called, whatever rumor is being spread about you, it's now published. It's now permanent. And I think the same kind of bullying and manipulation happens now with kids that happened back when you and I were teenagers. The difference is that adults now have a record of it. They can look and see, oh, my God, this is what they're calling you? It's no longer some whispered thing in the hallway. It has a permanence. There's a trail. And I don't know if that makes it better or worse. It makes it a little harder to escape because a friend of mine who's active with the anti-bullying group GLSEN said, now you can't go to your room and close the door and be safe. You fire up your computer and there's somebody on Facebook mocking you. Kids, they're especially vulnerable, and that's why we see, you know, these tragic cases of kids who commit suicide. It's like, why? It's high school. You're almost out. Why would you give up like that? But we forget when we get older how painful that can be. You're like this newly hatched chick. You don't have any guard up. You don't have any armor. And I think what I tried to explore with the book is how that armor forms and how, if you're not careful, it can go so deep that it hardens you right to your core.
That's Anthony Bresnahan. His new novel, his first novel, is called Brutal Youth. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was 31 years ago this month that astronaut Sally Ride became the first American woman to fly in space. When the space shuttle Challenger exploded on takeoff, killing all on board, Ride played a major role in finding out why. And after leaving NASA, she founded a company to encourage girls to go into science. But when Sally Ride died from cancer 2 years ago at the age of 61, little-known details about her personal life emerged, including a long-term relationship with another woman. Journalist Lynn Scherr was covering NASA when she met Ride and the two became friends. Scherr has written a comprehensive biography, Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space, and she says She did not check her journalism credentials at the door when she decided to write about her friend.
I did it because, exactly because I knew her as well as I did, because I thought I could tell the right story. I also did it because there were things about her I didn't know. And when I learned about them right after she died, I realized this was an investigation I wanted to undertake, that my friend had withheld certain things from me and from the world, and I thought it might be interesting to see how that added to her character. Because, by the way, that's the way we lived our lives. She was my friend the whole time I was reporting on her, and I never compromised my ability to be a good journalist while I was reporting on her.
One of the things that was not out there was her very private life, the fact that she had a 27-year relationship with another woman, and that amazingly, according to, you know, the way you tell the story, it was not generally known.
Sally and Tam O'Shaughnessy, her partner, did have friends that they would socialize with, but for the most part, it wasn't. Tam prefers the word private. I think you could use the word secret. But she was concerned about the impact on NASA, which we only know because she said something about that right before she died. She also was concerned when she and Tam started their company, Sally Ride Science, that two women in a lesbian relationship might have difficulty raising money to support this extraordinarily wonderful company that was going to get girls interested in science and math. I am very sorry that our culture and our society was one in which there was some shame and fear, although with Sally, you never would have known that because there was always a smile on her face, and she doesn't seem to have been downtrodden by this.
Let me ask you, on page 44, you do one of the sort of journalistic tricks, and that is to ask a person to define themselves. So could you just read us? There's a paragraph at the bottom, I think, of page 44.
And if you woke up Sally Ride in the middle of the night and asked her what one word best described her, a question I often pose to size someone up, she would say, according to everyone who knew her best, physicist. She liked the fact that only 90-some naturally occurring elements comprise everything from a grain of sand to the furthest star, that physics means being precise, not arbitrary, that it dwells in the real world with natural law. These were Sally's most comfortable coordinates.
Was Sally Ride really a serious scientist?
Sally was absolutely a serious scientist. And, you know, I had a conversation with one of the few of her students whom she mentored, and he had a wonderful way to describe her. He said she was a physicist who took a detour through space.
Well, now, one of the most interesting things about Sally Ride, I thought, was the extraordinary thing that happened to her when the Challenger fell. It changed her life. It changed her feelings about NASA, which had been like, you know, the firmament in which she moved.
And she went from saying, I'm going to get in line for my next flight like everybody else. All I want to do is fly, 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 to reassessing and going back to a plan that had somewhere been in the back of her mind, which was she was only going to stay in NASA for X number of years and then get back to physics research. Challenger was a moment when the scales fell from all of our eyes. But what was revealed after the Challenger explosion and the faulty decision-making of some of the managers, not everyone, but some of them, was a crime. It was absolutely a crime. And Sally saw it that way, too. And Sally then came up with the evidence, the first critical evidence, which we only now know about, did not know until she died, that NASA had tested the material in those O-rings, those giant rubber gaskets.
Everybody who remembers Challenger will remember that.
The gaskets that were holding together the segments of the solid rocket boosters. She was slipped a piece of paper, which proved that some in management knew that the rubber in the O-rings would not withstand those super cold temperatures. Challenger happened in January of 1986. Sally resigned from NASA in 1987.
And she never flew again.
She never flew in space again.
When do you think Sally became a feminist?
I think Sally was born a feminist. When she found that NASA was looking to recruit women, she knew she was the beneficiary of the women's movement. She always said that. Her mother had the great line, after Sally flew, everybody rushed around saying, what do you have to say? What do you have to say? And she said, How about God Bless Gloria Steinem?
Well, now, you know, for those of us who remember the day that Sally Ride flew into space, it's like remembering the day that Walter Mondale chose Geraldine Ferraro to be his vice presidential candidate. Those are milestones, certainly in my life. But what is her impact? Does she reach all the way out into generations who are still young?
Youngsters may not know exactly who she was or exactly what she did, but they feel her impact. There is no question about it. At the time, as you remember, she was the most famous person on the planet. She was on the cover of every magazine. 500,000 people lined the rivers and the coastline at the Kennedy Space Center to watch her lift off. Millions of people, mostly women, mostly young women, looked at her bold journey and translated into their own tickets to success. If she can do that, they said, I can do anything. This was the ultimate glass ceiling, and Sally Ride had crashed right through it.
Lynn Scher's book is called Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montagne.